Good morning. I cannot tell you what a joy and honor it is for me to talk with you today. When Associate AVP John Rosenberg called to ask me to speak, he told me that my talk would be a forum, but I was free to make it as devotional-y as I would like. Generally, a forum delivered by a BYU faculty member focuses on that faculty member's research, and so I will start there and see where we go. In that spirit, I'm going to talk about my academic research in the formation and financing of business entities, and hopefully try to tie my research into a broader conversation about the importance of strong financial infrastructure and human flourishing. As we journey together, I ask that you keep in mind the question of how societies ensure that their members receive value for their ideas and their work. My area of teaching and research is broadly business law. Today, however, I'm wishing that I had discovered a cure for a disease or invented some amazing technology or had been chosen to work on a NASA mission to study life in space. But in the next 25 minutes, I hope to share with you my excitement for business law and explain how business law can nurture, protect, and reward human flourishing. And as we talk about businesses, remember, we are talking about humans who are organizing their labors and activities in the business arena. In the end, I hope to convince you that training and experience in the law of business development and finance can lead to some life-changing experiences with unforgettable children of God. Broadly, the majority of my research and teaching focuses on the organization and financing of businesses from formation to the initial public offering. Today, I'm going to start at this end of the spectrum, the IPO, and work my way backward. As many of you know, the IPO is a rite of passage, or used to be a rite of passage, for the small subset of firms, mostly formed as corporations, who grow beyond closely held businesses to issue shares to the public and be listed on a national exchange. Corporations who launch an IPO move from the private capital market, in which they raise money from friends, family, and specialized institutions, to the public capital market. Ordinary investors, you, me, your grandparents, invest in public capital markets. In law, we talk about gatekeepers, institutions, and individuals that we believe protect the public capital markets from fraudsters and other bad actors. Besides the Securities and Exchange Commission, there are three non-governmental gatekeepers to the capital markets, and corporations must enlist the help of all three of them, a law firm, a public accounting firm, and an underwriter. Opportunities exist for conflicts to arise between the firm and any of these gatekeepers. When we say the firm, we mean the legal entity that is issuing shares to the general public. But of course, the firm was created by the founders, individuals with an idea. In many IPOs, the founders will control the firm alongside large investors such as venture capital firms or angel investors, unless the co-founders have ousted one or more of them before we get to a more formal stage. But I'll talk a bit more about that later. First, law firms that take the company public counsel firms to get their house in order and be honest and straightforward in their registration materials. Accountants perform their gatekeeping function by auditing the financial statements of the firm and providing comfort letters to the underwriter to make sure the books aren't being cooked and will only sign the required comfort letter to that fact if they are satisfied. Today, I'm going to focus on the potential conflicts with the underwriter. The underwriter is the investment bank, or usually a group of investment banks, that agreed to sell the shares being offered in the IPO to the public in return for a commission. These underwriters take on liability for fraud for any misrepresentations that the firm makes to the public and the SEC in connection with the offering. The investment banks act like a sales force, but because they're subject to liability for false statements and registration materials, they theoretically have an incentive to also ensure that the company is a straight, or at least not too crooked, arrow. However, conflicts can arise between the firm and the underwriter, though this conflict is strange because the firm hardly ever complains. Let me explain. Back in the day, before the internet, the underwriter was the sole distributor of information about an upcoming IPO. Underwriters met personally with potential institutional investors, think banks, insurance companies, and mutual funds, and high-worth individual investors, and tested the waters of how much they would be willing to pay for a share of the IPO firm, building a literal book of potential buyers. This in-person, face-to-face IPO process called book building remains central to the U.S. system even today. Book building leads to the confusing conflict between the investment bank and the firm, the underpricing phenomenon. Through the book building process, the underwriters determine the price at which IPO shares are sold, and they get to allocate those shares before the opening bell, giving those select persons the right to purchase the shares at that IPO price. Then, when the bell rings and shares become publicly available, in a hot IPO market, the shares can be resold to the public immediately and could be worth much, much more by the end of the day. This price increase is called the first day pop. But how big could a first day pop be? The average first day pop for all firms for the past 40 years is 18%. During the last hot IPO market, the average was much higher, over 70%, and for technology companies, even higher than that. During the dot-com boom, some firms saw their stocks double more than once in the first day. So how is this a conflict? How does this hurt the firm and the founders who created it? To understand this, we need to understand two things. First, the firm gets the proceeds of the sale of the IPO shares to the first buyers of this block of shares. The founders created a firm, and now they are selling shares to the public to gain capital to compensate themselves for their efforts and finance future growth. But the later resales of those shares from the first buyers to the new buyers in the secondary market are solely between those two parties, and the increase in price goes to the first buyer, not the firm. The second thing to understand is that the underwriter gets to choose the first buyer. The underwriter gets to choose who gets the IPO shares at the IPO price, for example, $20 a share, based on information gathered through book building. However, if IPO stocks in the U.S. on average increase in value 18% during the first few hours of trading, then the lucky few allocated IPO shares get the right to sell them the first day for a very quick gain. On average, the underwriter is handing the first buyer $3.60 per share in free cash, cash that should have gone to the firm. Imagine hiring a broker to sell your house, and the broker finds a buyer, a friend of his, who pays you $200,000, which your broker tells you is a good price, the market price. But then that friend resells it later the same day for $236,000, or even $400,000. You would probably feel a little bit suspicious. One reaction to the underpricing phenomenon is that the founders and the firm are getting cheated by their investment bankers. The underwriter is supposed to be out in the market discovering the real market price, but for some reason keeps mispricing the firm at 82% of the market price or less, shortchanging the founders. And of course, the reason could be to grant favors to their own investment banking clients who get to buy the shares at the discounted IPO price. One proposal from the turn of our new century was to harness the magic of the internet to eliminate intermediaries such as investment bankers and allow firms to access public capital markets and online auction IPOs. In a Dutch auction IPO, shares are sold online directly to investors in a process in which would-be purchasers submitted sealed bids for a certain number of shares at a particular price. The clearing price, or IPO price, is the highest price at which all the IPO shares would be sold, given the irrevocable bids. Theoretically, founders would then capture 100% of market demand, not 80-something percent. Not coincidentally, shares issued in Dutch auction IPOs generally have had low first-day pops, confirming the theory that the firm was collecting the full market price, with no underpricing. In an effort to brand itself, Google announced in 2004 that it would be one of the first firms to go public using an online IPO auction. However, Google's IPO proved to be the death of the online auction IPO. The institutional investors stayed away from what should have been the hottest IPO that year. The smart money boycotted the offering, the IPO auction that was supposed to bring this new technology into the mainstream, all but buried it. Firms did not abandon the Wall Street book building IPO. It turns out that the underwriters, and remember that there are only a handful of big time IPO underwriters like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, are necessary themselves for creating or at least discovering market demand. Consequently, 100% of non-underwriter-backed IPO market demand is usually less than 80-something percent of an underwriter-backed IPO market demand. Disintermediation is tougher than it looks. Though I was skeptical at first, I argue now that strong investment banks, and maybe even book building, can benefit startup firms seeking to access the capital markets. For founders to get the most value out of their creation, their firm, having strong market intermediaries to foster their IPOs might be best. As an aside, I blogged in the summer of 2004 that I didn't think investing in the Google IPO was a good idea. I was wrong. Unless you had other opportunities to deploy your capital at a yearly rate of return of more than 24%, it actually was a good investment. But back to our story. IPOs get a lot of attention, but interesting things happen in the life cycle of a startup firm before it gets to IPO. At the other end of the spectrum, one of the most fascinating moments in the life cycle is the very beginning. Business firms begin not as firms, but as business ideas. Though some big ideas come from the mind of one person, Many firms begin with two or more persons collaborating on an idea that may have sprung up organically. Or one person might bring the beginning of an idea to another person or group, and then each collaborator will bring different skills and perspectives to grow the idea into a business plan. Here, the law needs to work to nurture, protect, and reward the contributions of the individuals. Depending on the sophistication of the parties, the complexity of the business idea, and other factors, the collaboration may continue for months or years until a legal entity is formed, such as a limited liability company, limited partnership, or a corporation. At that time, the parties will decide which founders will have management roles and the participants' agreements as to ownership of the entity will be represented by shares in the corporation or ownership interests in the LLC or limited partnership. But what happens when conflicts arise prior to formal organization and formal documentation of ownership interests? How can law protect and encourage business collaboration? Those of you savvy about social media may recognize two notable examples of this type of conflict that resulted in litigation: Facebook and Snapchat. Facebook, as you may know, was first the idea of Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, brothers and students at Harvard, who, along with a third founder, Divya Narendra, approached fellow student Mark Zuckerberg with the idea to launch a website called ConnectU. The three founders gave Zuckerberg access not only to computer code, but also to the entire business plan. According to the ConnectU founders, Zuckerberg did not work on the website as promised, but instead secretly created the Facebook, using the ideas and code shared with him. Zuckerberg then incorporated his business as an LLC with Eduardo Saverin and Dustin Moskovitz, not including the Winklevoss brothers or Narendra. A slightly more recent example is the origin story of the social media platform Snapchat. Snapchat was created by three college students, this time at Stanford, not Harvard, Reggie Brown, Evan Spiegel, and Bobby Murphy. Reggie Brown came up with the idea of a mobile platform that would allow users to send pictures that then disappeared and shared it with Spiegel and Murphy. The trio spent a summer living together in Spiegel's father's home, working on the project, with Brown creating the now familiar ghost icon and applying for a patent on behalf of the three co-inventors. By August, however, Spiegel had locked Brown out of the platform and formed an LLC with Murphy to own the mobile app. Do these ousted founders have any recourse? How can the law protect those who contribute their ideas and labor pre-business form? The answer is one of my favorite legal doctrines, the de facto partnership doctrine. The oldest business entity form is the general partnership, which dates back to the Babylonians through classical Greece, Rome, Europe, and then specifically to the common law of England and the early United States. In a general partnership, two or more persons agree to co-own a business for profit. The persons do not need to make a filing or formally organize to create a general partnership or even have a written agreement. Under state law, a partnership is the default entity when a jointly owned business is not organized as anything else, such as a corporation or LLC. As long as our founders have agreed to work on a for-profit business venture together, they have formed a general partnership, and partnership law will step in to protect the partners. General partnership law, the oldest of our business entity laws, reflects core values of a society. Individuals choosing a small number of others to create a firm, the partners working to further the enterprise, sharing control. Partners have duties to the entity and to one another. The entity and the partners are responsible to the outside world for debts of the partnership. The partnership is more valuable than the sum of its partners. Limited liability entities like LLCs and corporations move away from this personal model, and the payoff is that business firms can be larger, can attract more capital from dispersed investors without familial or community ties, and can ensure management that they will be free from frivolous investor litigation. However, until parties form one of these entities, the law will consider them a general partnership. In a general partnership, partners owe to one another, in the words of Justice Benjamin Cardozo, the duty of finest loyalty that surpasses honesty alone. This means that partners may not compete with one another, may not use partnership property for their own gain, may not use confidential partnership information, and may not steal partnership business opportunities. The law is pretty clear. Zuckerberg arguably breached the duty of loyalty to his co-founders, and so did Spiegel and Murphy. The defendants in each of these cases settled fairly early on. The Winklevoss brothers were awarded $65 million in mediation, which they wisely asked for in a combination of cash and stock, which is now worth more than $500 million. Reggie Brown received $158 million to settle his breach of partnership duty case. Partnership law is powerful, and I believe, quite just. Not all parties to these so-called de facto partnership cases are college students or even unsophisticated parties. Sometimes they can be very sophisticated parties who try to disclaim partnership ties opportunistically after the fact to reap all the rewards from the collaboration. Though the defendants in these cases like to call the de facto partnership doctrine partnership by ambush or surprise partnerships, the doctrine is actually pro-entrepreneurship, pro-business. If parties cannot be protected when collaborating, then collaboration and the innovation it produces will be chilled. We want prospective founders sharing ideas, information, technical specifications, and we want them to share the rewards of doing so. The title of my talk is Capital Markets and Human Flourishing. Many, if not most, incoming law students would say that they were going to law school to help people, to make the world a better place, to fight for justice, including me, almost 30 years ago. Corporate law, tax law, partnership law, these endeavors don't inspire and motivate a lot of humanities majors to go to law school. In practice, we used to joke that we were making the world safe for large corporations. But here I am, and not only do I believe that well-run capital markets and robust legal doctrines protect entrepreneurs and encourage human flourishing, I've also had the surprising opportunity to use my corporation-centric experience to see human flourishing on the ground. As a few of you know, though a regular attender of our local ward, I'm officially a member of Community of Christ, formerly known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I come from a family of RLDS members, dating back to the early church in 1832. My husband, law professor Paul Stancil, is also not a member, but a religious evangelical Christian. As you might imagine, our long journey together has been a search for a spiritual home for our family, and that journey has taken us to some amazing houses of worship and allowed us to fellowship with strong believers of many faiths. While professors at the University of Illinois, we worshiped with a Presbyterian church that we still pray for and support from afar. After attending that church for a year or so, I became aware that a group from the church was starting a partnership with a village in Malawi, a country in which the Presbyterian church traces its influence to David Livingston, the Scottish physician and missionary. Though the group was close to making its first trip to Lisenjala, a rural village there, I suddenly felt that I was supposed to go with them. This was surprising mostly to me, because I am not an intrepid traveler. However, I moved forward in faith and found myself in a village lacking in water, electricity, and roads, but abounding in its own faith and hospitality. This picture is one of three groups of villagers who met us at the Blantyre Airport. These women are the Women's Guild of the church, sort of like Relief Society, but with a lot more dancing. The partnership was to have three prongs: water, secondary schooling scholarships — there's no tuition-free secondary school in Malawi — and microfinance. For several days, I traveled around the countryside with bankers from Opportunity International, a microfinance institution. I met owners of small businesses who were able to grow their modest ventures with the help of microfinance. Slowly, during that trip, I realized that I knew a lot about early-stage businesses and finance, and I had tenure. So, I devoted the next 2 years to learning everything about the current environment of international microfinance. I developed and taught a course on microfinance and even took law students to my beloved second home, Lisenjala. Founders need legal doctrines to protect and nurture their business contributions, and they also need creative capital solutions to finance their ideas and efforts. Microfinance allows micro-entrepreneurs, alone as sole proprietors or in groups like partnerships, to borrow small amounts of money for short terms to allow them to invest in themselves through the purchase of inventory for a small mini shop, a piece of equipment to make wares, or even livestock. I met entrepreneurs who made popsicles to sell when schools let out, who had market stands selling clothing, auto parts, groceries, and even rice farmers who created a co-op for both borrowing and selling purposes. Because mainstream banks aren't well-suited to provide financial services to the poorest of the poor, microfinance institutions fill the gap in developing countries with creative substitutes for credit scores and collateral. I learned many things from my adventure in African microfinance. One is that strong financial institutions and capital markets, along with roads, public education, electricity, shipping, water, healthcare, and a strong legal system, are vitally important to human flourishing. Commentators have mocked a particular politician for arguing that business owners did not build their successful businesses all by themselves. We like to believe that our success is due to our own individual efforts, particularly when those efforts have been extraordinary and have involved huge sacrifices. However, I have seen micro-entrepreneurs whose sacrifices and expenditures of time and energy rival anyone's, but without reliable ways to ship and order goods, hire an educated workforce, open bank accounts nearby, borrow funds, travel to and from during the rainy season, and enforce legal rights, they're not allowed to live up to their human potential. Yes, U.S. business owners have created amazing opportunities, but we have unappreciated luxuries of knowing the lights almost always come on, water is safe and plentiful, the roads are open, and our bank accounts are safe. And we have opportunities to invest our surplus in the best capital markets in the world. Yes, I learned that business law is vital to human flourishing. Whether that law protects the young person who shares her amazingly profitable idea with acquaintances, the young corporation that wants access to public capital markets, or the small business owner trying to access financial products such as savings accounts, credit, and insurance, strong legal frameworks for business benefit business owners, people. And human flourishing depends on the law protecting, nurturing, and enabling us to receive value for our ideas and our labors. On a more personal note, I also learned a lot about my purpose and Heavenly Father's plans for me during my trips to Lisanjala, and it's not what you'd expect. A made-for-TV movie would start with, Christian corporate law professor finds herself in the midst of rural micro-entrepreneurs, and then draw a straight line to enormous economic success. But neither I nor my church group brought about miracles with everything we touched. We had many failed attempts to provide water and secondary education to the villagers there. Our family decided to forego a fancy Christmas one year to finance the building of a well there. It went dry. Our first microfinance trust group ended when the chair absconded with the funds. I was a little disillusioned, to say the least. One of my favorite books is by Phil Vischer, the creator of VeggieTales, Me, Myself, and Bob. In that book, Vischer talks of how he had a dream to be the Christian Walt Disney and how he failed. Even you fans in the audience may not know that VeggieTales went bankrupt and was sold away, and Vischer lost creative control and the intellectual property rights to his creations. Struggling to come to terms with how he had a righteous dream to glorify God through children's Bible-based animation and how God let his dream die, Vischer had an epiphany. His purpose on earth was not to achieve his dreams, no matter how good or righteous they were. His purpose was to walk in the will of God. One night in Malawi, my law students asked me how I felt about the church partnership when we had so many failures. Most recently, we had trusted our friend in Malawi to administer our scholarship program by sending him the funds and letting him distribute them to the students. You may be able to predict how that was going to end, but we were not, and so we lost our monies and our friend. Nevertheless, I found myself telling my students, who represented a mixture of faith backgrounds, that our purpose here was not to bring water to Lisanjala, or to run a successful scholarship program. Our purpose was to show the love of Jesus Christ to everyone. And, in the words of Phil Vischer, to walk in the will of God. One more story of how I surprisingly found my background and expertise needed, but with mixed success. On my fourth trip to Malawi, I was going to walk 2 miles north of the Lisanjala Church to go to Tuesday Market. A young woman named Happiness offered to walk with me. She seemed like she wanted to linger there, so I thought maybe she wanted a treat, like a Fanta, before returning to the village. Happiness did not have many treats in her life. However, she turned down the Fanta, but asked if we could go to the Malanje Mission, which is 2 more miles in a different direction. I thought maybe she wanted to go to the hospital there, but she whispered, I want to go to school. To make a long story, not quite as long, Happiness wanted to go to high school, but she needed more than just tuition. She needed someone to get her registered in time for the next quarter, in 1 week. So as I said, I'm not a scientist or an inventor, but I'm a mom. And you can call me a helicopter mom or a snowplow mom or a lawnmower mom, but if someone needs to get registered for school, I can do it. And I know a bit about educational bureaucracy and other complex institutions. So we went to Malanje Mission. That afternoon, we were sent to 3 different places and then told to return the next morning. Happiness met me early the next morning so we could continue our journey, and she had brought a friend, Patricia, whom I also knew. Patricia said to me, I want to go to school too. That day, we went from office to office where male officials treated the 2 young women pretty badly and made them feel ashamed of themselves. My law mom training enabled me to advocate for them and finally get them enrolled, get them uniforms and their required haircuts. I would like to tell you that all went well. But a year later, we didn't know where Happiness was, though Patricia was still in school. However, I remind myself that my purpose wasn't really to get Happiness enrolled in school. My purpose was to show her how much Heavenly Father loves her. So much that he sent some crazy helicopter mom to her for a few days. Phil Vischer wrote in his book that our 5-year plan should not be to be the Christian Walt Disney, or to start a successful scholarship program in Malawi, or even to be a nationally renowned corporate law scholar. Our plan for 5 years from now should be to walk in the will of God. Thank you very much for hearing me out. I've talked about my favorite things, IPOs, the de facto partnership doctrine, microfinance, and VeggieTales. I consider every day that I teach at BYU to be a blessing and a priceless opportunity. Today has been the highlight of an amazing life, right up there with dancing, with the Women's Guild, and Lisa and Jala. Thank you.